As the U.S. military grapples with a growing insurgency in Iraq, Army leaders at home have resorted to unusual training methods for new soldiers, including a multi-billion dollar simulation that places soldiers into fake Iraqi villages to see how they will cope. With me now are filmmakers Tony Gerber and Jesse Moss, whose documentary Full Battle Rattle takes a look at this fake Iraq and whether it will help American soldiers succeed in the real Iraq. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Tell me, I mean, this fake Iraq is actually a military base named Fort Irwin. It's in California's Mojave Desert. Set the stage for us. What does it look like? I mean, it's huge. How big is it? Give me some of the numbers, because I know in the movie the statistics are just sensational.
Well, just to orient you, it's about 2 hours from Las Vegas. It's 1,000 square miles. There are when we started the film, there were 6 Iraqi villages with about 200 people in each village. There are now 19 villages. It's enormous, and they've recreated really the scale of an Iraqi province. And there are about 2,000 role players, Iraqi exiles who work as who play Iraqi civilians, and about in the village of Medina Wassel, where we set our film, there were about 150 U.S. soldiers who played insurgents.
And of course, this battalion, I mean, you basically followed one battalion's experience over a 3-week period in this village. Is the 3 weeks the full period of training that they would be spending there?
Yeah, that's right. It's 3 weeks.
How did you pick this battalion?
Jesse and I immersed into this world almost like characters jumping into down a rabbit hole, you know, not knowing who our characters would be. So we began casting for characters as we entered the world and learned the ropes of this world. So it was several days before I came across Lieutenant Colonel Bob McLaughlin, who has a sort of angelic face and a kind of innocence about him, but a kind of earnestness and a kind of gravitas that you might find in a Kirk Douglas in Paths of Glory.
We knew we wanted to set our film in the village of Medina Wassel, and the story of our film would be the fate of this mock village, whether it would tip into civil war or remain peaceful. And it was Colonel McLaughlin who was sent in to bring peace and prosperity to Medina Wassel. So he also kind of selected himself, and that he was responsible for Medina Wassel.
And just because there are layers here, I mean, you talk about casting, but it's a documentary, just so that listeners can keep this straight. There are these layers, and of course, there's an element of absurdity that one can't escape, or comedy that goes right alongside all that's very sort of haunting about the film. And that is, you have Medina Wassel, it's a simulated village. You are with a real battalion, but they do not know whether it will tip into civil war or whether they'll be able to tamp down the insurgency as they go about their war games. Does anybody know? Do the simulators have this all scripted out in advance?
No one knows. No,
so people are given their parts, and you document how these simulators script each character, and then the action actually unfurls as if...
Absolutely. It's like a giant theatrical improvisation. Everything is spring-loaded, you know, for action, but you don't know which way the village will tip, whether peace and prosperity will be achieved or it'll tip into civil war.
What was so interesting, too, is that the soldiers, Colonel McLaughlin and his fellow soldiers, are not playing characters. They're really playing themselves,
right.
And the stakes are very high for them. They're about to go to Iraq for real, and they will live or die. And whereas the role players in Medina Wassel step in and out of character all the time. And that kind of strange space was what intrigued us about the possibilities in the simulation.
But for the soldiers, they do take it as real.
Absolutely. I mean, the analogy really is like scrimmage in football. You know, the pads are on. It's hot as hell. You're sweating. You know, and someone sticks a helmet into your gut, it hurts just as bad in scrimmage as it does in the real game. And so for these guys... they eventually, you know, forget that that there's anything simulated going on. The stakes are very, very real for the soldiers.
Now, the soldiers are the part that you were probably drawn into. I assume that to some extent you heard this was happening. You were interested in what is it like for the soldiers. And then you get there. And one of the elements that emerges so strongly in the movie are these Iraqi simulators, people who are themselves Iraqis living in America, playing Iraqis, living in this Iraqi village, fighting Americans or under American occupation or cooperating.
It's a paradoxical existence for those folks. And in a lot of ways, we were drawn to the notion of Iraqi role players in the desert who were working with the soldiers. You know, one of the fascinating things that emerges in the film is this idea that the real Iraq is in flames. And, you know, for a lot of these role players, the Iraq that they remember no longer exists. And it's sort of been replaced by this simulation of an Iraq in the California desert.
And this space brought together soldiers and Iraqis. And I think in many of the documentaries we'd seen about Iraq, they'd either been about U.S. soldiers or about Iraqis. But there were really no film that had brought the two parties together. And that was the opportunity here, was to put them together in the same space.
And, I mean, some of these Iraqi simulators or actors who are making a living, I mean, I don't know how they find these jobs. But you have the man who plays the deputy police chief of the village, who is himself here as an illegal immigrant trying to – and he has an extraordinary story of how he got out of Iraq and so forth – trying to get citizenship. How did that story emerge to you? And tell me a bit about him.
Well, actually, it took us quite a while to realize that he was facing deportation. And that was one of the challenges of the film, was we airdropped into this place and had almost no lead time to get to know these people. Typically in a documentary, you might have months to build a relationship, and we didn't. But gradually it came out that he was facing deportation. On the other hand, he was being employed by the Army to role play a sort of schizophrenic existence, that one hand of the U.S. government wanted to send him home, the other hand wanted him to stay here in the fake Iraq. But his life was literally in the balance, and he faced, I think, the same fate that many Iraqis who work with the U.S. government or U.S. military in Iraq face, which is death if they're known to be collaborators. And so I think he hoped that his work with the Army would help his case. I mean, his fate was in the balance till the very end.
We've got a couple of clips from the film that I'd like to just to be able to hear here from one of the soldiers talking about the whole experience of the simulation, and from a couple of the Iraqis who are playing Iraqis and are Iraqis.
The battlefield we have created here at the National Training Center can be seen as a giant stage. It can be seen as a giant set with several different stages being the towns, or it can be seen as one big, large reality TV show. It's done with upwards of 1,600 role players, and 250 of those are Iraqi-speaking American citizens.
We live over here, we sleep over here, we eat over here, we cook over here, we do everything just like we are in Iraq.
When I first got this job, I called my mom and I told her, "Mom, I'm wearing dishdasha." And she was like, "What the hell?" I'm like, "Yeah, imagine, I'm in America and I'm wearing dishdasha."
I'm Philip Gurevich. I'm in for Leonard Lope today, and I'm talking to Tony Gerber and Jesse Moss about their new documentary film, Full Battle Rattle, which we just heard a few sound clips from. Tell me, when you've got play killing going on, as it were, you say that it's simulation, and that at the same time for the American soldiers it's also very, very real. But I imagine that the emotion is different when you know that if you hit a landmine, your buddies get blown up, but they also come to dinner again later. How does that work? How does the emotion work? And do you think this is actually effective and useful training?
Well, that's a two-part question, but yep. I will say that the fact that we were looking at fake violence, fake body parts, you know, and simulated killing enabled us to talk about larger truths, and in a sense to sort of sidestep a kind of implicit censorship that feels to be going on in the country right now. You know, we're able in this film to see a memorial service for a fallen soldier. And yeah, he's a fictional fallen soldier, but the tears are real. And, you know, I approached the shooting of that scene thinking, okay, this is going to be hysterical. I mean, these guys are faking a memorial service. But, you know, then you see the boots and the dog tags and you hear the bagpipes and you see these guys crying and you realize, wow, there is some logic to this, you know. But then on the other hand, there's a profound irony that, you know, preparing soldiers for war is actually teaching them how to deal with death. You know, and what does that say about this current conflict?
Well, I mean, I think throughout all of conflicts, one of the war theories or one of the war challenges in training soldiers is training them to kill. And I wonder whether you think that in training soldiers to kill actors, as it were, that they're shooting at people knowing that they're not really, really killing them, that it's a little bit more like a video game for them, or does it have the same reality when they then hit Iraq?
Well, I would say that I think that rather than training these soldiers to kill, in some ways they're being trained to die or trained to mourn and trained to be statesmen and trained to be, diplomats, which is maybe not what they signed up for. But that's the realities of the current conflict.
And maybe in this case, trained to fail. I mean, that's what happens in the simulation is they do fail.
That's right.
Although they don't. Though, as you say, there was nobody knew that before they went in.
That's right. That's right. But I think it. I mean, I think they realized at that point the enormity of the challenge they faced.
So when the simulators are scripting this, then these you show in some detail the simulators sitting around coming up with characters almost like screenwriters would, and building biographies for people and supplying people with these things. Do you think that they're scripting failure?
No, not at all. I don't think so, no. I mean, but one of the things that's fascinating about that scene or those scenes that reoccur in the movie, that group of writers are actually known as the Lizard Team, which is sort of fascinating. What's implicit, I think, in that material are these sort of assumptions. Those are civilians who are contracted by the National Training Center. And they're researchers, and they really are writers. But many of them have never been to Iraq, so they're compiling these scenarios based on reams of research that someone has fed to them. So the notion that a model, and in essence, our film is looking at the simulation as a kind of diorama of the real war. It's the real war in miniature. So this study of this miniature thing tells you as much about the model as it does about the model makers. So the film really speaks to assumptions, cultural assumptions.
And you talked about the soldiers at a funeral, at a staged funeral, experiencing real grief, real emotion. What about the role players? Did they experience real trauma? Did they enter their roles to that degree? You said that they were different in the sense that they entered and left their roles in the course of a given day, which the soldiers don't.
Well, for example, there's a character in our film, Sergeant Paul Green, who plays an insurgent and really enjoys killing American soldiers. He has a good time doing it. But he himself is a two-time veteran of the war in Iraq. He's been there twice and had friends die in Iraq. And I think he also is aware of the fact that as easy as it is for him to do this in the simulation, it will be in Iraq. And so I think he sort of experiences that contradiction, and it's difficult for him. At the same time, he's safe in the simulation. Up until the point where he gets himself deployed for a third time.
Well, I guess the soldiers who play the Iraqi insurgents, the American soldiers who play Iraqi insurgents, are really in the literal physical role of kind of devil's advocates, right? They represent the enemy, and their job is to make it as hard as possible for their own men. It's interesting that they seem to be the only ones who are having a really good time. How do you account for that?
How do we account for that? I think the Iraqis are also enjoying themselves, I got to say. I mean, a lot of them, have been doing this for several years now and are really attached to the place and reference it as home in our film. And what is it, Jesse? They spend 7 months out of the year living out there in Medina Wassel. And as I mentioned earlier, I think for many of them, the irony is that being out there brings them closer to a homeland which doesn't exist anymore. So I do think that there's a kind of, for the Iraqi role players, a summer camp kind of component to their lives out there.
My guests are Tony Gerber and Jesse Moss, speaking about their new documentary, Full Battle Rattle. This isn't the first time, is it, that the Army has chosen to use large-scale simulation of the sort that you were filming at Fort Irwin?
It's not. In fact, the National Training Center had previously been a Cold War simulation training facility where they fought tank-on-tank battles. So they really just reconfigured it as an urban warfare simulation. And actually, in the course of making the film, they've begun to refit it yet again as an Afghan war training simulation. And so the Iraqis that we followed may be soon losing their jobs.
So they'll bring in Afghans?
And so in a sense, the simulation endures, the wars change, and the cast changes, which was it's a frightening statement made by one of the subjects of our film, Colonel Kramer, who helps run the facility, that the National Training Center endures, that in essence the war machine grinds on regardless of the war.
Why did the Army – I mean, I can see why any filmmaker would be compelled to be drawn to this. I mean, the sound clip that was played earlier calling it a kind of reality TV show set or reality movie set in this sense where you have these layers. Why did the Army let you go? Was it difficult to get permission to make the film? And what do you think they wanted from the film or thought they were getting?
I think that, you know, we had to jump through a lot of hoops to gain access. And first and foremost, they kept wanting to see us as affiliated with mainstream media. They wanted to know that we were from a Discovery Channel or from a History Channel or something, which we weren't. And we were self-financed and we were independent filmmakers, so we very much flew beneath the radar. But by hook and by crook, we gained access, which was through an office in Hollywood that manages all representations of the Army in any film, whether it's a Michael Bay film or it's a little documentary by Tony Gerber and Jesse Moss. We eventually got permission from this office, and once we got out to the simulation, we were doing something that no one had ever done, which was complete and total immersion. We lived the simulation, and eventually we were forgotten, you know. And there were many times that soldiers, mistook us for role-playing journalists. And we should mention that there were role-playing journalists out there, which is right. Fascinating. They're training soldiers to deal with media in the battlefield as well.
I mean, I'll also say that I think the Army would have preferred we make a film that was about whether or not the training was effective. And I think that was the film we chose not to make.
Presumably they, as you said, Jesse, I mean, they've done this before, and they're planning to do it again, using it for Afghanistan. They obviously must think that this is a training model that is effective. Did you come away thinking it was, even though that's not at the core message of your film?
I mean, I think the danger is that it gives you a sense of control that you may not really have in reality. I think it does reduce anxiety on the part of the soldiers.
Is that good?
I think it is good, but on the other hand, that maybe gives you that sense of control that you simply won't have in the theater of war for real.
Now, this battalion that you followed, how did they feel about being filmed? They forgot about you as well, or did they become attached to you?
They became quite attached. In fact, there was a lot of pressure to deploy with them. They thought it would be kind of fun, like having a mascot along, you know.
To go to Iraq with them.
Yeah, that's right. I think.
When
that,
did they deploy?
Deployed in October of 2006.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And are they still there then, or are they?
They're back.
They're back.
Some of them are getting ready to go back, second tour.
How'd they do?
In the battalion, which is approximately 500 soldiers, five died. But I'll also say that Colonel McLaughlin feels that they did well in their mission in northern Iraq to contain the insurgency.
Where were they based?
In Mosul.
So and you decided not to go with them. That was that
it
tempting?
Wasn't, it was, well, sure, it was tempting. I think, you know, I don't know. I have a wife and a child, and as does Jesse, and so there was a lot of resistance to that idea.
But it really would have brought the film back to what we didn't want it to be, which was an assessment of the training value of the simulation, whereas we wanted to leave people with the story that we told in the simulation of the fate of this village. I mean, that was really our story. And I think sort of what that story said about the larger war was what we wanted the film to be, not so much whether Colonel McLaughlin was or was not himself successful in Iraq.
That's right. It would have been something of a trap, in a sense, you know. And we had to work very hard to sort of avoid letting this become a film that served as a referendum on the effectiveness of training. That wasn't what we were interested in. And in the end, it's a slippery slope, because how do you quantify that? Is it about how many men die? Is it about how much food and relief supplies are brought to tiny villages? I'm sorry.
What was it? Yeah.
I know. I just had a voice in my ear. Forgive me. It was an otherworldly simulation experience there for a second. Maybe it was a flashback to Medina Wassel. No, but the point is that that I think it's very difficult to quantify the effectiveness of the training, and it wasn't the scope of what we were doing.
I'm Philip Gurevich, and for Leonard Lopate, I'm speaking with Tony Gerber and Jesse Moss about their film documentary, Full Battle Rattle, which is showing right now at Film Forum. Why hasn't this story been out in the press before. I mean, is this were you the first to actually cover this training base and what was going on at Fort Irwin?
Well, there had been some newspaper articles, about 2.5 years ago, reported on some of the training that was happening there. New York Times had run a piece. But I think up until that point, the Army had kept it fairly secret. And so we saw an opening that clearly there was some willingness on their part to allow scrutiny of the simulation training. That's where we dove in.
No one had spent this amount of time there, you know, and that sort of became a novelty. The public affairs officer, who was effectively the press agent for the place, at some point started sending journalists who wanted to do, you know, a short story to us. We sort of became the point of contact out in the box, as they called it, because we knew the ropes. They literally sort of forgot about us in a fascinating kind of way, and just we had free reign.
Now, Tony, you've worked on Broadway, you've worked on the musical Rent, and Jesse, you've produced other documentary films, PBS and HBO and so forth. But I'm wondering, when you're on this particular film, when you're at Fort Irwin in the desert day after day, does it seem to you like you're documenting a series of unfolding, unpredictable events? Or does it seem to you, with all the fake blood and the sort of cuts in the action that are directed by the military themselves, like a movie set?
Well, both. I mean, and that's what intrigued us. And I mean, the films that were reference points for us and pursuing this documentary were more the work of fiction. The war films that inspired us were Dr. Strangelove, Robert Altman's M.A.S.H., Three Kings. I mean, these were works of fiction that we felt were interesting because they approached war from an unexpected direction. And I think many of the documentaries we'd seen about Iraq felt, you know, they were powerful but expected. And I think there is a kind of collective fatigue about how people were receiving information, stories, news about Iraq, and we saw an opportunity to do something different, to inhabit a different space, and tell a different kind of story, and one with humor too. I mean, I think the film is funny and it's surreal and it's highly entertaining, but it's also provocative and I think very emotional, and I think finding that a place that would allow for all of those tones was what we were seeking in the simulation, what we saw.
Well, it does have all of those elements. I mean, it is certainly funny. And you talk about Dr. Strangelove and M.A.S.H., both of which are deeply sort of satirical films. And mm-hmm. And that's what's striking, is that your film manages to be quite funny and deal with the absurdity of it without being, strictly speaking, a satire. Was it hard? Did you feel that you were pulling back, as it were, your own opinions and messages and trying to stay out of the way of the thing? Was that difficult? Did it require a restraint?
Very much in the edit room, yes. Uh-huh. And that was maintaining that balance between tragedy and comedy was critical to us and was maybe one of the hardest things to achieve. We worked very, very hard to do that. The film functions as a kind of Rorschach test in a fascinating way to people of different political orientations and opinions of the war, and it's fascinating for us to see the range of reactions to it.
Have you shown it to military audiences?
Yes, we have. Yeah. Well, Lieutenant Colonel McLaughlin was with us last night at the film forum, and it was quite fascinating. And I think for audiences to hear from him afterwards. And again, it's not a referendum on the effectiveness of training, but that's usually one of the questions he answers. But, you know, you realize to what extent, particularly on the East Coast or maybe in New York City, that we're culturally isolated and that this country is increasingly divided. There's military culture and then there's sort of, you know, highbrow sort of intellectual culture, and ne'er the twain shall meet. And it's fascinating to bring those two groups together in one room.
And what do the military make of it? What does Colonel Laughlin say?
Well, I think he's a very sympathetic character in the film, and I think he was relieved to see that he was presented, I think, quite fairly and honestly, and that audiences, whether they're progressive or not, respond to him. And I think that was a relief to see that he was not made fun of, you know, it wasn't a hatchet job. I mean, I think we really stood back and let this story unfold and speak for itself politically, and I think there is a political message in the film, but I think, you know, I think we let audiences discover that in a way that I think was comfortable for Colonel McLaughlin and the other soldiers who've seen the film.
But we were making this film for ourselves, you know. I mean, we were making this film not to make the army happy, not to make the, you know, the anti-war movement happy. We were looking at this simulation really as a kind of prism through which to view the war. And so maintaining this tone that you referenced was really very important to us, a sort of a tone of neutrality.
When you were out there in the Mojave Desert, did you ever just sort of think this was like being in Iraq? You were there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. I joke with my wife that, you know, when I'm old and senile, that I'll actually think that I served.
I've been speaking with Tony Gerber and Jesse Moss about their film Full Battle Rattle, now showing at Film Forum. Thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Philip.